Dr. Shiv Devrao is a cardiologist and co-founder of Abridge, who have raised over $22 million. Think of Abridge like an Alexa or Siri or other voice assistant that sits there whilst the physician and patient talk. Instead of the physician writing notes during the consult or staying late and charting, Abridge listens to the conversation and writes up the notes for them. Similarly, instead of the patient frantically taking notes or being bombarded with information, most of which they'll forget, Abridge can send them an appropriately pitched record of what was said with key takeaways. We talk about how Shiv has built and scaled Abridge. I ask him about the existential threat of large language models like ChatGPT. He talks about how being in the intensive care unit is similar to building a startup and how operating from a place of abundance is one of the keys to success. I hope you enjoy.
I started off college with a very kind of divergent mindset. I wanted to really explore, figure stuff out, find out what really resonated with myself. I think I was definitely kind of subconsciously rebelling against all the Indian doctors in my family and the world. But I really wanted to make a point of tasting as many things as possible. And I think part of that was probably informed by, like, towards the end of high school, one of my closest friends, died. He died. He was murdered. And I think when I went to college, I came in with this, I have to figure life out a little bit for myself. I don't want to go to trade school. So there was that silver lining to that loss that I experienced as a kid. I remember being in college, like, super idealistic. I was that that really idealistic, like, kind of art schoolish kid who had a piece of paper in my wallet, and it was like a Rilke quote. And the Rilke quote is like, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves, like lock rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. And don't seek the answers, which can't be given to you because you won't be able to live them. And the point is to live everything, live the questions now. And then perhaps one day you'll gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. So that was like my mantra in college. Like, I'm just going to live the questions, figure this out, and find out what's out there for me and what I need to do. Like, what's my place in the world? So it was very J.D. Salinger coming of age book that I was living in college. It was like late in college that this visiting professor, so I was at Carnegie Mellon University, William McDonough, an architecture professor, sort of visited CMU, and he told the story about how we're all designers of our world. And he talked about this ophthalmologist in India who had designed this revolving platform that he sits on. And he brings patients in at 12, 3, 6, and 9. And he does a cataract at 12, and then he says spin. And then he does another cataract at 3, spin, 6, spin. And he's just spinning all day long, giving eyesight to people. And by the time I had heard this lecture, he had given eyesight to over 1 million people. And he taught this procedure to his daughter, who'd given eyesight to over 400,000 people at the time. And I remember leaving that lecture mind blown, like, this is the kind of value I want to be a part of. Not that it's, you know, more profound than any other kind of value people can create, but this is mine. And so, you know, my parents for sure, like, secretly rejoiced that I was trying to now create a path towards medicine and healthcare. But I had to do a couple more things that I think have been really foundational for who I am and the work I'm doing today too. So I got really into music. I've always been really into music, and I had a scholarship year at Carnegie Mellon University where I got to, you know, work with virtual synthesizers and do some like lightweight programming and create music. And my roommate had a record label. He was selling records in Japan and all over the world. It was kind of avant electronic. And so we just made music. And it was just an amazing experience. And all the while, though, I was starting to create this path to get into healthcare, you know, with this sideways approach as a non-traditional applicant. So got into med school after that. And med school was really boring. Like, I found it to be really boring. It was a lot of memorization, and I didn't see a lot of room for creativity, like that story that inspired me to get into this space in the first place. And when I looked at the ways you could do research, I have utmost, you know, admiration for people who do hardcore clinical research, and certainly everybody does basic research, but I couldn't do that basic research. 13 years bench to bedside, I don't have the attention span for that. So I went to University of Michigan for more training, internship, residency, and fell in love with clinical care. all of a sudden I could be creative, because that's really what clinicians are. Like, people think they are scientists, but really they're like alchemists. Like, they're artists. They're being so creative in terms of connecting so many dots across a patient's social history and their background and their families and, you know, their allergies, but also what's going on with them right now, to come up with a plan. And the plan is never the answer to a USMLE or MCAT question. You know, there's always so much more that goes into the art of medicine. So I really fell in love with it. All of a sudden I was being creative. And I also fell in love with this idea of, like, well, what about tech? You know, because just around then, like, the iPhone had come out. So, you know, that's how old I am. But, like, the iPhone had come out and I was like, wait, this could like kind of totally change the game on what it means to create impact in healthcare. There's just so much opportunity. So taught myself some Ruby on Rails, created a web app for the residency program that helped residents sort of put all their kind of information in one place to justify the decisions that we were making every night in the hospitals, so that everyone could learn from each other, that there could be this, like, sort of network effect across medical education. And I experienced for the first time some peasant level of product market fit, because people were like, the residency program director said, like, hey, we might want to pay you for this. And I was like, wait, what? And so that was where, like, the first, like, the beginnings of me starting to converge a little bit. Even being in med school, I had this divergent mindset of, like, exploring and doing other stuff. But I sort of started to see, or started to recognize, that like ophthalmologist story, like getting to impact at scale, that you could do that with tech. And now all of a sudden, like, all that experience that I had from being an undergrad at Carnegie Mellon University, it felt like, oh, I could connect these dots, you know, tech and healthcare. So fast forward later, went to cardiology fellowship, had a first startup where at night myself and co-founders were in an incubator at Carnegie Mellon University, and we were starting to manage, you know, teams and engineers. And that was a great way for me to very quickly get steeped in all things like startup and learn how you actually build something. And we got to term sheets with someone, but, like, it was a good litmus test for me, that idea that it didn't really meet the mark for what I was trying to do or get at. But I stuck around that health system and got super lucky, because that health system, UPMC, is really large, has incredible scale, but it also has this entrepreneurial mindset baked into the DNA of the organization, where they have a payer arm, like, of insurance companies. They have a provider arm with all their 40 plus hospital systems and all the clinicians and nurses, you know, doctors within them. But they also have this innovation arm, like this tech arm, that they were starting to invest incredible amounts of capital into. So I was at the right place, right time. And people said, like, hey, you should split your time and be half-time doctor, half-time, you know, tech innovation. And I got to do that at first. And over the course of, you know, I think, like, 5 or 6 years, I violated Peter's principle like 10 times, I think. Like, I started as, like, the token Indian doctor on a team who had, like, clinical insights, and then kind of graduated to being a head of strategy, and then, like a head of product, a head of strategy, and then ended up being an EVP there, which meant I could be a check writer, who's one of three check writers there who could invest UPMC's capital into tech startups, but also invest into other places. So, like, we invested significant capital into Carnegie Mellon University to start a machine learning and health program. And that's where a lot of the founding DNA for a bridge comes from.
I'm really interested in this idea of cross-pollination and how people bring ideas and thought patterns from other industries into building in health. And I guess your unique cross-pollination path might be, or one of them might be, that you had this kind of creative flair, this foot in the design world, the music world, etc. What kind of things do you think that's allowed you to do, or what kind of thought patterns has that brought to what you do today with a bridge?
Well, I remember even at that architecture's lecture that I got to go to as an undergrad. This is when, like, the D school at Stanford was pretty young, and he was talking about, like, T-shaped thinking or T-shaped people, where you can be really deep in one domain, but you can cross the T with, like, even a seemingly disparate discipline. And now all of a sudden, as one individual, you're connecting dots and coming up with ideas that would take a lot longer to kind of get to. Anymore, it feels like, even now, like, in terms of the work that we do on the AI side at a bridge, domain transfer. It comes up quite a bit, style transfer. And those sort of spaces are so exciting to me because it's sort of like transposing an idea from one space into another. With, you know, my position as like a tech CEO now and thinking about my background as a clinician as well, there are so many dots that you can connect, like from one domain to another. There's a way to apply them. But I think the key is, from a mindset perspective, you can't silo your experiences. Like you can kind of let one bleed into another. So we were chatting earlier about this, but oftentimes I feel like being a startup CEO is like being in the intensive care unit. And that's my favorite place to be in the hospital system, because you're in the ICU, and I love the urgency and the amount of agency that you have as a professional to save a person's life. Like, I'm a cardiologist, someone comes in with a heart attack, or someone comes in with cardiogenic shock, and you have to very, very quickly build a prototype. Like, this is what we think it is. And then you've got to figure out a plan to test that prototype. You're going to like start a whole bunch of IV medications or do a bunch of procedures, but then you're going to measure as fast as you possibly can. And then depending on the numbers you get, you're either going to pivot or persevere. And you drive, you know, like you drive something to a conclusion and you save people's lives. And that's, I think, in so many ways, as a startup CEO, especially in the earlier stages of our company, it felt like, despite having incredible venture capitalists, at the end of the day, you're on this journey to get product market fit. And on the road to PMF, your patient, your startup, is an extremis. It's in an ICU, and you have to build a prototype and see if it fits, see if it works. And you keep building and measuring and learning and iterating. And like, the faster you can go through those cycles, the better chance you have of your patient walking out of the room. And I think, like, in a startup world, it's your startup actually having PMF. And now all of a sudden the world is different. It's a totally new game.
So the idea of a bridge is amazing. And I think it's something that at least 10,000 other people must have discussed whilst doing the rounds. Like, wouldn't it be, I think you have clinical scribes, we call them junior doctors here. And you're kind of following the attending around, scribbling down everything they're saying. And you just think, wouldn't it be amazing if, you know, we have the technology, why can't this be automated?
Yeah.
But clearly it's not happened, or it's not widely been adopted yet. So why is this problem more difficult than it seems on the outside? And can you also fill in with some of the story on how you went from idea to execution?
When we first started the company, we had this idea. We had like strong opinions about what like the experience needed to invoke for both sides, the professionals and the patients. And in our first seed deck that we pitched to Union Square Ventures, who is one of our major investors, we told this story about being able to benefit both sides. And it's the story we're still working towards and we're now unlocking at scale in the market. And what we realized very quickly was like the barrier to entry on being able to build a solution, not just a demo on the professional side, that could integrate into workflows, into the medical record systems that we were really like targeting from a business perspective, that it's high. Like, there's a lot of deep tech that you need to do and a lot of deep engineering that you need to do to create the seamless experience that you could imagine in your head. And on the deep tech side, for us, what that really meant was that we needed to do research. You know, we needed to do AI research, and that Carnegie Mellon DNA gave us the ability to do it. And our UPMC DNA gave us the ability to aggregate de-identified data at great scale, and then not just aggregate it, but also annotate it in the shape and form that we needed to build models that could lead to the experiences that, you know, we imagined. So we spent years annotating, aggregating data, and building models. And we started the company in March of 2018, just a few months before Google had published that paper, Attention is All You Need, about transformers, this new type of machine learning model. And so that was in the back of our heads the whole time, and in all of our papers, in some way, shape, or form, we're leveraging a transformer and pointing at a specific healthcare challenge in our pipeline. So while we were doing that deep tech research, that has now kind of culminated years later in a full stack solution on the enterprise side. But back then we didn't want to hold our breath and just do research. We wanted to like create value as soon as possible. So we put out a consumer version of our application. So we were sort of like, hey, the barrier to entry here on the consumer side is so low. Like, what are we waiting for? Like, we know that the future looks like professionals using it and then sharing with their patients. Like, that's the viral coefficient there is a lot greater than like going direct to consumer in this space. But like, why hold our breath? Let's start helping people now. So in July of 2019, we put a free consumer app out there. We made sure that all the privacy and security specifications met the right kind of level of the right standard. We're at the highest level of standards for healthcare. But we put it out, and before we knew it, we had hundreds of thousands of users on the consumer side, actually with permission, capturing conversations, maybe just snippets, maybe just the next steps with their professionals. But they were capturing conversations that were then what we do in that consumer app. We don't just sort of capture the audio. We also transcribe just the medical parts of the conversations or like an abridged transcript. But then we can also layer on health literacy. So we decode all the jargon that the professional didn't even know they were dropping on you at a fourth grade reading level. But then I think most exciting is we can nudge you in a week or 2 weeks, reminding you like, hey, we think you were supposed to get an echocardiogram. We think you were supposed to take metoprolol, and we can kind of help you be the healthiest version of yourself, because there's great research to suggest that people forget up to 80% of what they've heard from their doctor or nurse. It's just how we're programmed as humans.
Wait, how did you get to hundreds of thousands of users? Did you do that organically? Did you have some kind of crazy viral marketing campaign? How do you do that?
Organic. You know, we put a consumer app out there, and I think one of the first areas that latched onto it were chronic disease communities. Because when you think about it, like, let's say you're on a cancer journey, it's so hard to be in the moment, especially when you're getting a new diagnosis. But even after that, it's so hard to be present in the moment. You're preoccupied with all the anxieties, all the stress related to your diagnosis. And the medications that you take in and of themselves can cause what they call chemo brain, where you can't remember. And so those communities were the first highly engaged, highly activated sort of patients out there, people out there who recognize like the value proposition, and who to this day, every week we'll get some kind of review or some kind of email saying this is the most important thing in their care journey, or this was a game changer or a lifesaver.
You know, with the data that you're collecting, you have all these unstructured voice records of a patient-physician encounter. Obviously, what you do at the moment is really interesting and really useful to people, but have you thought about the possibilities of, once you have these unstructured, non-digitized voice interactions and you have them in some kind of machine-readable format, what can you do with that? Like, what opportunities are there?
Yeah, absolutely. We're already creating value on a lot of the downstream opportunities of the document itself. So when a bridge is a part of the conversation, we cannot just summarize it. We cannot just create different versions of a note that can help both sides of the conversation, but other customers of this note as well, and payers, like insurance companies, come into the picture there. Another thing that crushes my soul is having to field all the prior authorization requests that might come from an insurance company asking me, why did I order this MRI for a patient with cardiogenic failure? Was the MRI the right thing? Like, should I order another test? And we can start to really unburden people on use cases like that. We can start to unburden use cases related to the problem list and coding as well. Those use cases are very much like adjacent to the conversation itself. But even further downstream, there is, I think, what you're getting at, which is like there's a pure data clinical analytics opportunity here too, to be able to, in a privacy preserving, in a secure way, understand patterns across care that's being delivered, so that we can, you know, do a better job of any number of things, from, you know, identifying which patients might be good candidates for clinical trials, to understanding sentiment around a specific new, you know, medication. I mean, there's just infinite use cases because of the thesis. And I think that we'll always return to that thesis. As long as our thesis is correct, that when you think about it, healthcare is really about people and they're having conversations, then all this opportunity is really downstream. And I think there's a lot of challenge here. We need to be in the workflow. We need to work with the medical records and the other systems out there that are central to the way care is delivered. But pulling it off and getting into those workflows unlocks just infinite opportunity.
I want to talk a little bit about large language models like what we've seen with ChatGPT and potentially the threat they pose. So here's my take. I can imagine that you've been building all this awesome stuff, and then overnight you log onto your computer and you see the ChatGPT demo. And now suddenly overnight, and maybe I'm getting this wrong, so feel free to correct me, but some kid at university could use speech to text software and then plug that into ChatGPT, use a prompt like, can you summarize this for the average US citizen? Can you summarize this for another clinician? And quite quickly build like a Frankenstein's monster version of a bridge. And I would immediately, you know, I'd have palpitations and think, what's going on? Was that your experience? Do you agree, disagree? Where do you stand?
It's a tailwind. Like these technologies are an absolute tailwind, because what they do is they move value up the stack. So I think what these sorts of foundation models and other technologies that will like prop up over time, what they will do is they're giving us all tools. They're giving us new primitives that we can plug into our existing pipelines so that we can focus on the next problem and then like the next problem and the next problem. And so I think what it will also do, it will help companies sort of differentiate on value that's higher up in the stack as well. So you can like jump up, and it'll also help make clear how important it is to be in the workflow, to be integrated. It'll make clear how important it is to be trustworthy. You know, it's easy, I think, to your point, but I don't know that it's that much easier today than it was yesterday to create a really compelling demo in this or in any other space. You know, you can duct tape a lot of different services together and create a proof of concept. But especially in industries like healthcare, that is a really important conceptual first step. But the real work is ahead of you in terms of being able to create something that's trustworthy, that can integrate into workflows and actually, you know, reliably work. So that turns into the moat, I think. And I think we've always recognized that in healthcare, especially, trust is the most important network effect. You know, these new foundation models have changed the game in the sense that they differentiate who the AI native companies are from who are the companies that are thin layers to a foundation model that need to optimize for a totally different type of go-to-market and growth strategy. If you're an AI native company, then you recognize that where the moat is in building machine learning beside those models, on top of those models, beneath those models. Like there are companies that need to fine tune those models for their specific use case, which means they need proprietary data sets to be able to pull that off. If you're not doing that and you're a thin layer on top of a large language model, for example, then where is your moat? Number one, but then number two, how are you going to fit? How are you going to build trust as an enterprise grade company where, you know, chances are every time you hit that model, you're getting a different answer. So it really, I think the name of the game right now is, yes, you can create compelling demos with these new primitives and demonstrate a concept, but the real work is still ahead of you if you're trying to build, you know, an enterprise grade company. Now, if you're a consumer company that is all about growth first, and you've been financed to go after a growth first, second, third strategy, even in 2023, then what you really need to do is just like build that thin layer, put it out there, aggregate users, and then figure out how to build like a traditional network effect or other form of defensibility in the future. Now, that's not our game. We're trying to build real deep AI native. So for us, all the investment in machine learning and having a chief scientist like Zach Lipton is critical. To our identity.
Shiv, if in 2 or 3 years you're sat around in a restaurant or a bar with some of your friends and you're saying, look, man, this didn't work out. My company's dead. I lost everyone's money. What do you think would have been the reason behind that? What do you think the most likely reason that would have happened would have been?
The reason what most startups go sideways is going to be lack of focus. It's going to be that they didn't sequence steps in the right order. And I think every startup needs to know when to play chess and needs to also know when to play Monopoly. And I think that being able to shift gears between chess and Monopoly and know when it's time to go, you've explored enough, it's time to exploit, create value. It can be a hard, it can be a difficult kind of decision for leaders to make. And timing is a big part of that as well. Like knowing when it's time, you know, to shift from one gear to another. So I think that, you know, when I look at this dispassionately from the outside, the space, and especially like health tech, it's companies that didn't time that sort of mindset shift that I think are the ones that had worse outcomes that were had suboptimal outcomes. I think that it takes a certain mindset and it takes a certain ethos also in the boardroom for companies to be able to like always invoke first principles and look at the space dispassionately and make those right decisions.
So it would have been something about you exploring too much and maybe not exploiting or just getting distracted. And then, so the follow on is that how do you stay focused? How do you know when to explore versus when to exploit? Have you got any wisdom on that, or do you have any kind of thoughts on that?
I think to some extent, being able to channel your own intuition is really important. As much as people want to make this very much like a numbers game, there is so much intuition that goes into this as well. You sort of feel it in your bones sometimes when it's time. And we've certainly felt that way for a moment now. And so we're in a different gear as a company at the moment. And the things that can really kind of knock you off your game are operating from a perspective of scarcity or fear. Like as soon as those questions, those insecurities start to seep in, I think your vision of the market and your company, they start to get obscured, and you start to, you know, you're turning that drunk person under a light post looking for your keys, like just hoping that something will work. But when you're operating from a place of abundance and you're always trying to channel, you know, clarity, and you're trying to channel, you know, you know your own inner conviction and like that compelling future that helped you like sort of start the company in the first place, you end up making those decisions that need to be decisive, that won't be informed by all the data, but will help you decide between which adventure you need to be choosing at any given time.
I want to get your thoughts on what you've learned about leadership, and let me just propose some statements. So are there times when you have to be a bit of a dick to be a good leader, or in other words, not be everyone's best friend in your leadership? And then secondly, maybe you could touch as well on your points around when you are a leader, kind of putting forward that clarity and that hope and compelling future element as well that we were talking about before. So yeah, do you want to riff off what you've learned about being a good leader?
Yeah, I think that how you feel inside, like that internal milieu, is going to be how you project yourselves externally, whether that's to your board, whether that's to your employees, whether that's, you know, to whoever. So it's so important, you know, to always kind of be kind of locked in. And if you're starting to see or feel yourself fray, then you've got to take that beat to get back into gear, because it's going to have ripple effects. It's going to affect everything across the company before you know it. Those three things that I think are so important to channel for yourself, but then also externally with the company and everybody else around, is, you know, clarity. Be clear so you can stay focused, but on what you want to achieve, but also like certainty. You need to feel it in your bones, as I said before, like what you're doing and why you're doing it. So important, I think, to start with the why. Like these are all airport business book sayings, but like there is profundity in them. And then, you know, finally, you need to like always channel that compelling future, which is a part of that why. But like, why are you doing this? Why are you working like an intern every year and probably, you know, why would you be willing to do that forever for this mission, you know, for this why? So like that, there's a compelling future that you're working backwards from. And so being able to like stay as close to that as possible, I think makes you indefatigable. Like it just gives you energy reserves to be able to do anything, because like the line between work and life is totally blurred. You're doing this because you want to. There is no distinction for me on a daily basis. It's all the same thing. So if someone were to ask me, like, how many hours do you work a day? I don't know. Like, it's all the same and it's all amazing. And I'm grateful for all of it.
Well, Shiv, let me pull you up on the first thing I said, though, that was around, you know, because you seem like an exceptionally nice person. But are there times where, as a leader, you can't be everyone's best friend and you've had to kind of learn from that? Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as the CEO of the company, I have five jobs. I've got to nail down the strategy of the company. I have to make sure to deliver capital for us to pursue that strategy. I have to build the team to execute against that strategy. I have to channel clarity, certainty, and a compelling future in how I communicate that strategy internally and externally. And then the last piece that I think you're invoking is, like, I got to hold people accountable and I got to hold myself accountable. And there are absolutely skills, you know, on the accountability side that you have to build, you know, as a manager. There's a part of this that I think is just dispassionate. You've got this why, you've got this, like, mission, you've got to achieve it. You've got certainly certain metrics that you're holding yourself and everybody else accountable to. Everybody's on the same page on those metrics. Everybody's aligned. We're pushing the same rock up the same hill. And at that point, I think it just becomes a dispassionate kind of survey, like a conversation of, like, here's where we are. Here's what we've done. Here's what we've not done. Like, what's going on? And you move from there. So I don't know if it's the way I see this, but I don't see that as, like, necessarily like a big challenge per se, as much of, like, a thing that is just a part of the job and it's part of the mission.
Have there been any habits or ways you approach problems that you think have helped you get to where you are today?
I have a mentor who also kind of reminds me of a few things that I should always kind of keep in mind. And one is just perspective. Another is, like, what's your purpose? And then the other is, like, gratitude. And his advice to me was, try to channel those three things at night, like, before you go to bed. You're going to wake up with all this drive, like, all this, you're going to feel unfulfilled. Like, that's the fire in your belly to go do something, and go do it, execute, get stuff done. But then at the end of the day, try to pop your head up again and get into that meta level of, like, what's going on? What's the bigger picture? Like, where, how do I fit in? What's my purpose? Am I achieving those things? And then I think naturally from there, like, gratitude flows. Another aspect of, I think, my daily regimen is to take a minute, or take a beat, I should say, like, at the end of the day, to try and unplug into something else where I can lose myself a little bit. I can kind of get into that, like, no ego state. And whether that's playing chess with my kids, or, like, you know, or going out and, like, working out, whether that's listening to music. But being able to get into a flow with something that's outside of the norm, I think allows ideas inside the company that I have to incubate a little bit better and faster.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please consider leaving a review. Thanks for listening.